How hard is it to make ends meet in South Florida? Very. Charlie Kirk's death motivates his movement at FIU, and South Miami declares victory in its immigration suit. Sort of. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at United Way's discouraging new revelation that half or most residents in Broward and Miami-Dade counties are living paycheck to paycheck. We'll also speak to a Florida International University alum about the late activist Charlie Kirk and how his Turning Point USA has galvanized campus conservatives. And South Miami Mayor Javier Fernandez will discuss the less-than-clear end to his city's suit challenging immigration enforcement cooperation. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. South Florida's affordability crisis is deepening again. That's the message from a report out this week by the nonprofit United Way that shows more than half of Miami-Dade County residents live in an economic limbo it calls ALICE, asset limited, income constrained, employed. In plain speak, that means they can't make ends meet. They may be working, but they're living paycheck to paycheck on the financial brink. United Way found half of Broward County's residents are ALICE. Across Florida, almost half. Living under the ALICE threshold can mean having a job but not having a place to sleep. That's increasingly common in a region where the median home price is 10 times more than the median household income, and where the average one-bedroom apartment in Miami rents for more than $2,000 a month. But housing is just one millstone around South Floridians' necks. Other basics, from food and health care to transportation and child care, only add to the Sisyphean task of getting ahead here. Are you or someone you know living in an ALICE situation? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss this crisis is Samaria Hudson. She's the president and CEO of United Way Miami-Dade, and Kathleen Cannon, who is president and CEO of United Way Broward. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you so much. We're happy to be here.
Thank you, Tim.
Samaria Hudson, can you start by reminding us what it is exactly that ALICE measures and how it determines if someone is living on that brink we described earlier?
Well, the ALICE data has been collected for several years now. So for the state of Florida, we've been collecting this data since 2014. And really what we look at is the overall health of the people that are living in our communities, the financial health of those individuals. And just like you said, I will tell you, Miami-Dade County, we're at 54%. So that's 527,000 households
right. That
fall under the ALICE threshold.
Right. But can you, as I ask, can you tell us what are the criteria that you use in the ALICE measurements, you know, besides, housing, for example? I also mentioned you look at basic cost factors like food, healthcare, transportation, et cetera. What is it that you're measuring to determine if someone is, as I said, living on that economic brink?
Well, those are the factors. I mean, mm-hmm. Those are the key indicators as to whether or not someone is able to really meet the basic needs within our community. So whether it's housing or transportation or food prices, we also look at overall inflation in our community. Mm-hmm. We look at whether or not a person is their wages, whether they're underemployed or they have unstable employment. So those are the factors. So when we look at the actual income of those individuals that are in that category, mm-hmm. The median income is roughly for a family of four, it is $72,000. But it takes $89,000 for
right.
that family of four to even make ends meet or survive in our community.
Right. So Miami-Dade's ALICE numbers for the year 2023, correct, in this particular report, that's 54% of residents here, as you mentioned. That it seems especially high. I should point out 19 other counties in Florida had equal or higher percentages of households living on this economic edge. Still, in Miami-Dade, we're talking about more than 500,000 households, as you mentioned, by far the most in the state. I know the Miami-Dade ALICE share was even higher a decade ago. Since then, the trends seem to improve, but now it seems to be rising again. What's most troubling to you, Samaria, about this new 54% mark?
Well, I think what's troubling, certainly back in 2020, 23, we saw 51% of our population in this category. And that number is quite interesting because we were coming out of the COVID period.
Right.
And then since that time, we had a lot of people moving into South Florida, specifically Miami-Dade County. The average income of those that were coming into our community was $246,000. And so we're bringing in an influx of incredible people with higher wages that are certainly putting more pressure on this inflation rate. Miami-Dade County has one of the highest inflation rates across the state of Florida. We're looking at 4.9%, which is well above the national average of 3.2%.
Right.
So certainly all of this is troubling for us, but I will tell you, we still work in a community where there are people that are working on solutions, including Miami-Dade County, to help support those folks that are in this
Right.
category.
And Samaria, what stands out most for you today in terms of what Miami-Dade households are struggling with when trying to make ends meet? In terms of cost, for example, I mentioned the housing challenges in this county at the outset there, but also in terms of jobs. What sort of jobs do most of these residents living under the ALIS threshold do?
Well, let's start with the breakout of those costs. So, Tim, you also nailed it. I mean, housing costs is a big challenge. We've been talking about affordability for quite some time across both counties, whether it's Broward or Dade. So, about a third or more of a person's paycheck goes toward housing cost, and then another 20% goes to transportation costs. So, you got to take 50+% out of that paycheck just to make those basics. And then you still have food, you still have child care that you have to be concerned about with this particular family if they have a child. And so that's one of the biggest opportunities there. And then also let's look at the wages. A lot of the community within Miami-Dade County, they're working for wonderful small businesses, but their income is going to be inconsistent. Some of them actually be maybe working part-time jobs,
Right.
and then a lot of them don't have benefits. So now we're looking at all of those, plus the multiplying effect that we have individuals that don't have stable wages.
Yeah, I think that you nailed a big factor there that I've often heard other experts in this field talk about, the fact that people who are having to work two, three jobs a day, it just doesn't amount to what someone who is, making a more stable living can bring forth. Kathleen Cannon in Broward County, 50% of residents are struggling below the ALIS financial hardship threshold, if not below the poverty level. How does this compare historically for Broward County, Kathleen?
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having us here. So we're going up. The threshold for ALIS and folks in poverty is rising. The last 3 years, we started out when we did the report in 2023, which you mentioned there is a lag in data because it does say, take some time to collate the data. In 2023, 46% of our residents were in ALIS threshold, and then 48, and now we're at 50%.
Right.
And
And Kathleen, what stands out most to you about Broward County in terms of the biggest burdens putting residents under that ALIS threshold, both in terms of costs and the kinds of jobs they have, as Samaria and I just discussed for Miami-Dade?
yes. So the ALIS population, now we named this back in New Jersey. United Way had done this ALIS report. Florida was the second state to really produce and really look at this report because more people were coming to United Way for help than they've ever come before, and they were working folks. So we really needed to study this. What is happening that folks that are working hard, doing all the right things, cannot make their ends meet for no fault of their own? So it really has so much to do with housing costs. There is healthcare costs, there's childcare costs, transportation costs. The folks that live in this ALIS threshold are really one little emergency away from crisis. So if a car breaks down, if somebody gets sick and there's out-of-pocket expenses. And then during COVID, as we know, we saw rents rise. Those increases in rents is what threw more people into our ALIS threshold. And of course, their wages are not keeping up with the rise in costs and with inflation. So there's so many critical things as United Ways here in Miami and Broward and through the state that we're trying to do to support ALIS community. Like we have a shrinking middle class happening here. And we're really trying to be focused through public policy, but through initiatives with financial assistance, but new workforce skills,
Right.
affordable housing.
And Samaria, we should note the total share of households in this category includes people experiencing on the brink financial hardship, but also people actually living below the poverty level, correct?
That is correct.
And
So,
in Florida as a whole, your report shows 13% of residents living below that poverty level, with 34% living under the ALIS threshold, bringing the total share in Florida of people living on this brink to 47%. So in Miami-Dade, I just wanted to ask you, how does that break down, in particular for Miami-Dade County?
absolutely. So the ALIS population, we're looking at about 39%, and then those that are at that federal poverty line is 15%. So that's exactly the threshold below. Certainly, that's the 54% that measures those populations of those households that are below the threshold.
And Kathleen, how does that break down for Broward County?
Yeah, similar. We're at 15% is poverty. So we. When we're talking about ALIS, we're talking about folks that are not in poverty, right above poverty, but yet cannot, again, like we said, make ends meet.
Right.
But through the United Way and many nonprofits here, we're obviously helping people in poverty and the ALIS community.
And one interesting thing I wanted to ask you both about was one of the things I noticed in the United Way report is that for the state of Florida, the share of residents living under the ALIS threshold, meaning the residents who might be working but they're still on the brink of poverty, looks to be at an all-time high since you started the survey. What about 15, or looking back at years 15 years ago? I think 2010 was the first year you looked at these numbers, right? But Florida residents living in poverty, in actual poverty, appears to have plateaued. It's not getting worse. What should we take from that sort of dual look at these numbers that you've given us?
Yeah, that is correct. It is, which is nice, right? That it has plateaued, that it is not continuing to go down. It was going down for many, many years. So there are services for people in poverty. There are some entitlements. There are other resources that people in poverty can access. People in the ALIS population don't have the same access to those types of
That's
services.
a great
So
point. Yeah.
This makes it doubly hard. Like when you see somebody that's homeless on the street, you know a series of terrible events have taken place and that person needs help. ALIS, they're all coming to work for us. There's 50%, like we said, in Broward and 54 in Miami, coming to work every day with a gigantic cinder block on their shoulders or an anvil on their chest because they know they cannot make it to the end of a paycheck.
Yeah.
But yet they're coming to work. They're teachers, they're nurses' aides, they're serving our food and our coffee, they're nonprofit workers. So this is why studying ALIS and surrounding it with services and support is so important because
Yeah.
they run our community.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line here who did not want to give her name, but she's a professor and is having a hard time making ends meet. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What has your experience been?
Well, I work full time at a public university, and I can tell you I'm not the only one in this situation. And I struggle every week. I am constantly having to postpone bills. I can't make ends meet. I'm a single income, and I really wanted to share because I think people are ashamed to say it when they're at certain professional levels and don't realize this is happening to so many of us.
Can I ask what percentage of your income goes to housing each month?
Does that include utilities?
Sure. However you want to convey it.
I'd say that's probably 50% right now, and I don't live luxuriously.
50%. Okay. This is the South Florida Round. Thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate it, and we hope you're able to, as we were saying before, make ends meet more effectively in the near future. Thank you very much again for calling. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. I'm speaking with Samaria Hudson and Kathleen Cannon of United Way about their new so-called ALIS reports showing an ever-growing number of South Florida residents living on the brink, paycheck to paycheck, amid our deepening cost of living crisis here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9577. Samaria, as part of its report on your analysis, the Miami Herald this week profiled a 63-year-old woman in Miami who has a full-time unionized janitor's job at $16 an hour, or $3 more than the state minimum wage. All this year, though, she's been sleeping in her car. One of the things that strikes me, though, is that in Miami-Dade County, low-income workers have a dilemma. Because public transit here is so substandard, they almost have to have a car to get to their jobs, but those car expenses could be going toward rent, for example, if they could get to work by other means. How does that sort of dynamic exacerbate the making ends meet problem here?
Well, certainly transportation has become a huge challenge here in South Florida. And so there's a lot of groups that are trying to figure out how we can ensure that we have, you know, certainly different means or more affordable means for people to get to work. But I will tell you, the other side of this coin, Tim, is how do we ensure that we increase the wages of those individuals that are in our community? And I think that's where workforce opportunities, upskill programs like what we have at United Way Miami, providing that type of support to those individuals so they can increase their skill level and go into higher paying jobs. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be a bigger challenge for us to all figure out. And what I love about the community that we live in, Miami-Dade County, there are private and public partnerships that are coming together to ensure that we address these issues that are in our community. But the one thing that we can do at United Way Miami is provide that financial stability support to those residents, provide them with skill opportunities so they can go into higher paying jobs.
Mm-hmm. No, and as you mentioned, there are a lot of private public partnerships like Chapman, et cetera, that I know they do more than just, you know, shelter homeless people. They there's a lot of job training, et cetera, that goes into efforts like that. Kathleen Cannon, when we look at the current causes for how increasingly difficult it is to make ends meet in South Florida, one of the culprits often mentioned is the COVID pandemic and how it resulted in a lot of affluent people moving from out of state into places like Miami-Dade County and Broward and helping drive up the cost of basics like housing. Has that been a significant factor to your mind? And if so, what are some of the other factors we can point to?
Yeah, Tim, that was such a significant factor. We saw, and you reported on this, we saw how rents increased so much. We did a housing report with FIU recently, and 6% of people in Broward that want to buy a house can afford to buy a house. So it's rental, but it's also home buyership. Mm-hmm. That really cost went up so much. But inflation went up. Many people lost jobs or lost wages during COVID. And again, 1 week out of a paycheck spirals somebody. And the last thing that we want is people in Alice, you know, to spiral into poverty. So housing is the number one culprit, but it's transportation. And you've also reported on this, the cost of early childhood care. High that, you know, we talked a little bit, a family of four here in Broward needs $102,000 to just make that. It means that's $51 per hour for both parents to be able to sustain just livable.
No. I became a grandfather this year, and I can't believe what my son is telling me, quoting me in terms of childcare costs that they're facing.
Yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just the caller before. So that is so not unusual. That's exactly why we started to study and publish the Alice report, that people that are working, again, doing all the right things, you know, the American dream, they cannot get ahead. Just what you mentioned about what Samiri mentioned in Miami Herald, we have folks that are working full time and homeless, living in their cars, going to work every day, figuring out how to do that. So, you know, this is why we have public policy. The Miami United Way, as well as Broward, we work on state policy, we work on national policy. We have to come at this in multiple levels: policy shift, policy changes, new initiatives. We have put a whole new realm of financial assistance in place just to get people stabilized while we get them new skills and new jobs. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to come at this from every angle. And the government can't do it alone. Nonprofit can't do it alone. Philanthropy can't do it alone. We really have to come together and work on this.
Samaria, as we mentioned earlier, the ALIS numbers are growing across all of Florida, not just South Florida. In fact, since 2010, it seems the number of Florida households living under the ALIS threshold, according to the United Way report, has risen 70% to more than 4 million. That is, of course, also a factor of the state's population growth, and mm-hmm. the share of households living on the ALIS brink has pretty much held steady since 2010, actually. But either way, it indicates Florida has not yet been able to get a handle on its affordability crisis after all this time. Why do you think?
Well, I still think it's some of the same factors that we see in both Broward and Dade, quite honestly, Tim. I mean, Florida has been one of those states where a lot of people from other parts of the country have been attracted, have been attracted to. They've moved here after COVID or even during COVID. So it's been a very attractive place for a lot of high earners to move to. So I really think that getting some of the housing issues solved, bringing on online more affordable housing, I think that's going to be one thing that's going to help tremendously. When we talk about almost half of someone's paycheck going to rent,
yes.
that clearly is an opportunity for us to zero in on that and figure out how we can bring more affordable housing online. And I want to go back to something, Tim, because I think it is important to talk about some of those solutions because there are folks that are hurting today. We can wait for affordable housing, but it takes time for those things to be built.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to some of the more basic things that we are doing at United Way. And I do want to zero back in on this jobs training program, because I think that is really important. As folks come into our community, as organizations or companies coming into our community, we are now looking at companies that are bringing more diverse industries. So the folks that are in Miami-Dade County need to play in that space. Healthcare companies are expanding. Hospitals are expanding. We now have aviation that's growing. So there's a lot of places where people can work. And so that's why upskilling and reskilling individuals to go into those jobs are very important.
That's always been one of the big knocks on South Florida, is that we're just a low-wage tourism, construction, whatever, you know, a low-wage economy down here. There was some good news, for example, recently Palm Beach County, you know, they're becoming, quote, the Wall Street South, as they're calling themselves. They seem to be making some real strides in bringing, as you termed it, Samaria, more upscale wage jobs, tech jobs, etc. Do you think Miami-Dade and Broward could be learning from what Palm Beach County and West Palm Beach are doing in that regard?
Well, I think we can all learn from each other. But what we are doing specifically is for those jobs, you still need skilled labor.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You still need people that are in those communities that have a chance to go after some of those jobs. So one example, Tim, is that through our upskill program, we provide scholarship opportunities for folks to go back to school.
Right.
We have a tech program. And so we're getting frontline people that are normally maybe working as a customer service agent, going into those educational programs, and then they have employment thereafter.
Yeah.
And so far now we've have 1,100 people that have enrolled into our upskill program.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of that, we've have almost 700 people that have gotten jobs across aviation, cybersecurity, healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the role that we have to play and ensuring that we can expand the wages of those in our community.
Kathleen Cannon, in the minute that we have left, I just want to give you the final word. What are your perspectives then on the most important recommendations for making Florida and South Florida affordable for the folks who do the important but not highly paid work in our midst?
Yeah. So it like I said, it is a mix. There's multiple levels. It's a multimodal response. We did a $10 million investment into affordable housing. So our investment was the subsidy for all these new apartments that are going up for the next 50 years. But along with Miami-Dade, we have to upscale and upskill. We have to remind people that there are good paying jobs here. It's an economic imperative for us to manage the ALIS population. We want to bring more business down here.
Sure.
We have to really get a handle on some of the housing costs and work together again. I think this is something we're hopefully the next ALIS report is going to be moving in a better direction because of some of the new interventions.
Mm-hmm.
But we appreciate so much you highlighting the importance of our ALIS community.
Well, best of luck with the future efforts. Kathleen Cannon is president and CEO of United Way Broward. Samaria Hudson is president and CEO of United Way Miami-Dade. Many thanks to you both. Still to come, Well, we were going to be talking about Charlie Kirk, but it looks like we'll be talking about Donald Trump's presidential library. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Well, for this segment, we had hoped to talk about the late Charlie Kirk and his conservative activism and the Turning Point USA movement that he has founded at so many U.S. colleges, including Florida International University. We had hoped to speak with Kristen Lamera, a recent FIU graduate and herself a former president of the universities of FIU's Turning Point USA chapter, but she has apparently not been able to join us for this segment. However, in its place, we have another Trump-related topic, and I say Trump-related because obviously one of Charlie Kirk's, the late Charlie Kirk's biggest achievements was getting young voters to vote for President Trump in the last presidential election. But as I said, we have another Trump-related topic here to discuss, which is this week's somewhat controversial decision on the part of the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees to essentially gift a parcel of downtown land to the Donald Trump...
to the Presidential Library Foundation.
Presidential Library Foundation. Thank you for that. And that voice you just heard was the guest we have with me in the studio now to discuss this matter, our government accountability reporter, Josh Ceballos. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, Tim. Thanks for having
Thanks very much for stepping in at the last minute on this. Again, we are discussing the... as I said, somewhat controversial gift that the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees decided to give this week to the Presidential...
Right. It's the Presidential Library Foundation, but I should note that what the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees actually voted on was to convey the land over to the state.
To the state. Okay,
and
good.
But the state has said that the state cabinet will plan to vote to... now convey that land over to the Presidential Library Foundation. So it's sort of just it's going to go through very easily.
Explain to us what the Presidential Library Foundation is exactly, because I made the mistake of starting to say the Donald Trump Presidential Library Foundation, but this is something more general.
Right. So this is the foundation that funds the presidential libraries, like the, you know, Ronald Reagan Library or what have you, throughout the country. And the plan is to create a Donald Trump Presidential Library. Mm-hmm. They've been planning to do one in South Florida, in Miami,
right,
for some time now. And the current plan is to do it in downtown Miami, in this land that's currently a parking lot next to the Freedom Tower in downtown. That land was owned by Miami-Dade College, but now they've transferred that to the state.
Okay. Why Miami and Miami-Dade County, though, when it would seem to make more sense that Palm Beach County would be the place for this, since Mar-a-Lago, that's President Trump's real base in South Florida, no?
That's fair to say. However, there's a couple of different factors involved, including the fact that the Trump family has said that they want to include a hotel at the Trump Presidential Library, which mm-hmm. would make it the first presidential library to have a hotel.
Okay.
And this is prime real estate. This is right in front of Bayside Marketplace and the Kaseya Center, where the Heat play.
And this is where the real controversy comes mm-hmm. in, right? The Miami-Dade College Board is essentially gifting a parcel of land that's worth almost $70 million.
That's correct.
For this. Why do you feel you think that's rubbing a lot of people the wrong way?
So, like I said, this is prime real estate. This is downtown Miami. Everybody knows your previous segment was about the affordability crisis, particularly downtown Miami. Very expensive place to buy real estate. And this was right in front of the bay, right in the heart of downtown with all this business around. And the Miami-Dade County property appraiser valued this land, all the parcels, all the folios together, at around $67 million. However, that's low ball. You know, we wouldn't know the real market value until it goes up for auction.
Did you speak to anyone on the Miami-Dade College board about their rationale for this vote?
Yes, we spoke to Roberto Alonso, who's one of the trustees, and he said that the state, through the governor's office, sent a letter to the board of trustees saying, we want you to convey this land over to us. And Roberto Alonso's position is that this was basically, their vote was a technicality because they're part of the state board of the state college system, that the state has the right to just take this land, and they It's just a formality for the board to vote on this. That's his position.
Sort of like the way the state was able to take the land over for alligator Alcatraz out in the Everglades.
Correct. So the governor's office...
sort of dynamic, right?
Right. So the governor's office said, we want this land. The board of trustees said yes and voted in a special meeting. And I should say the special meeting, the notice for it didn't say much. It just said a real estate, you know, transfer. They didn't say what the land was, what it was for, or anything. And then this all happened very quickly.
Why then are we assuming that this is going to be land for the Donald Trump Presidential Library?
Because that's what DeSantis has said in numerous statements, and as well as James Uthmeyer, the Florida Attorney General, who had a produced video on X talking about this.
And again, you mentioned this is not just a presidential library plan. This is a sort of a multifaceted development kind of idea going on here. Can you lay it out for us what they're actually planning here?
So, I mean, the Presidential Library Foundation would be creating this library, which, you know, it would be named for President Trump, but it would be a library, a place of research. And that's what Roberto Alonso is also saying. This would benefit the college that way.
Okay.
But the Trump family has said they want to add a hotel to that property, which would make it also a commercial, you know, interest.
Well, this
for the
is
president.
Donald Trump. I mean, it would have that commercial facet to it. Right?
But you're right. But that's not what the initial plan for that property was, according to some folks that we spoke to.
Mm-hmm. The land, though, has some interesting history tied to an important figure in Miami-Dade College's legacy. Can you tell us about how the college came to own this property in the first place?
Right. So Miami-Dade College in 2004 purchased this land in downtown, which is very close to just a few blocks away from the Wolfson campus, which is in downtown Miami.
Right.
And the president of the college at that time was Eduardo J. Padron. You might know him from another campus, his name on it.
I know him very well.
He was president for, 20 odd years. And at the time, he told the Miami Herald that the college was landlocked because the real estate market in downtown was so hot, and they needed this land to expand because the student population was growing so much. Mm-hmm. And so they bought this for around 20-something million, 25, 26 million at the time, and it's only gone up since then. Padron, I actually called him, and he said that the idea was to build something on that lot, maybe a conference center, maybe something for New World School of the Arts, like a theater. They had all kinds of plans in place. And he was shocked to see this news that it was just given away for free. He hadn't even heard about this until it happened, and he said this was unimaginable.
Well, we should mention, though, in context, there is a fraught relationship between Dr. Padron and Governor DeSantis in many ways, no?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and so that plays into this as well. Did you get a chance to talk to Dr. Padron, Eduardo Padron? Does he have anything to say about this, what a lot of critics are calling a giveaway?
Yeah, I mean, he said he didn't even know that this was going to happen. He was traveling, and then he saw the news and was sort of shocked because the college had gone through a lot to purchase this property for the good of the university, or for the good of the college and its students. And to see it just kind of given away for free was very shocking, and it really left an impression on him. And he said that he hopes the public really scrutinizes this, because he said it would be a sad day for himself and all the trustees who worked hard on this. And he made sure to note that this was not a political opinion that he had. It could be named for anyone. It doesn't matter if it was Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He just said this was supposed to be for the college, and for the college to give it away was very weird to him.
And what has been the response of the college itself?
The college, when we reached out to them, sent us to talk to Roberto Alonso, who's on the board of trustees. And he says that this is going to be a benefit for the college and for Miami. It's going to be an economic engine, that college students can go to the library to do research about civics and history of the presidents. So he says this is great. This is going to be a great thing. And he also said that there were no plans in the works to build anything on this property. It's just a parking lot right now.
Yeah,
that he hadn't seen any plans to do anything with it. So it didn't really matter for them to give it away.
Well, then finally, what's next for this land deal? Is there any sort of vote still pending? What are the next steps?
So the next step is on September 30th, the Florida cabinet, so Governor DeSantis' cabinet, will be voting on whether to give this to the Presidential Library Foundation. But maybe a lot like the Board of Trustees vote, this might also just be a formality. A lot of them have already spoken up. James Uthmeyer, Blaise Ingolia, and DeSantis himself have said, yeah, we can't wait to give this for the Presidential Library.
Interesting. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's Government Accountability Reporter. Josh, thanks as always.
Thank you, Tim.
Still to come, South Miami claims a sort of victory in its immigration enforcement lawsuit. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Earlier this year, it looked as if just about every county and city in Florida was bowing to Governor Ron DeSantis' demand that they sign on to what are called 287G agreements and have their police partner with the feds on immigration enforcement. After all, the governor claimed, that cooperation is now mandated by state law. But one city, South Miami, said, hold on. In reality, Florida's new immigration law mandates no such thing. And so South Miami filed a lawsuit to confirm that Florida cities are not legally bound to enter into federal immigration enforcement partnerships. And then, during oral arguments last month, the state's lawyers conceded South Miami's point. This week, the judge in the case dismissed South Miami's suit, though. But at the same time, South Miami is nevertheless claiming a victory of sorts that might prompt other Florida cities to reconsider 287G. Are your local police now immigration cops, too? What do you think of South Miami's stand? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is the mayor of South Miami, Javier Fernandez. Mayor Fernandez, thanks for talking with us.
Tim, it's a pleasure to be with you.
When you and I spoke on this show earlier this year about South Miami's lawsuit, you felt confident that Leon County Judge Jonathan Sostrom would rule in your favor and affirm that Florida's new immigration statute does not, in fact, compel municipalities like yours to partner with federal immigration authorities. Why do you think Judge Sostrom instead just dismissed your suit this week? Judge Sostrom said in his ruling, for example, that South Miami's suit was sort of putting the cart before the horse because it was claiming exemption from a state rule it hadn't been punished yet for defying. How do you read all that?
Look, I think it's in this environment, I'm not going to join what's the trend lately and criticize a judge or the judiciary for its ruling.
Okay.
I think in an environment where too few people are showing restraint, the judge, and admirably so, decided to excuse himself from what is a political controversy. You know, I think the message and the vindication I feel we take away from this litigation is that the state, in its own defense of its position, because it was a tortured position they took, admitted that in doing nothing, we do not violate the law. And so my takeaway and my message to other cities is, again, take a breath. There is no mandate as conceded by the state. If you do nothing, you do no harm to your city.
Okay.
In terms of it standing legally or to the public.
But I want to go back. I was not criticizing the judge's decision. Please believe me. I'm really curious to know a little bit more about why you think the judge did dismiss that. You said essentially he didn't want to become involved in a political imbroglio. But why on a legal basis do you think he dismissed the suit?
Well, I think he said, you know, you've not been directly threatened, and so it's premature to ask for declaratory relief. You know, I think, Tim, had a city like Key West joined the lawsuit, which had voided the agreement and been directly threatened by the AG and the governor, maybe the outcome would have been different, and we would have gotten a ruling on the merits. That's how I interpreted the decision.
Okay. So in the end, though, you seem to feel it really doesn't matter because you say a de facto decision was reached in the case last month when the state's lawyers essentially conceded, or as you say, conceded, your suit's point about the law. What did those state lawyers admit, in your opinion, in that hearing?
They said expressly, and I'm happy to provide anyone who wants to read it, the transcript, that there is no mandate, that we're not required to do anything, and that a violation of the statute in advancing a sanctuary policy would be in denying the adoption of an agreement, but simply not considering one, not taking any action, not taking any affirmative steps to prevent the city or its administration from entering into such an agreement was not a violation in and of itself.
Is it your opinion that the statute that we're talking about here says essentially that local governments can join in 287G agreements with federal immigration authorities, but they don't have to? Is that what?
That's been the point from the beginning,
right,
Tim. Is that, you know, the governor has been trying to make it seem that we are required to. We certainly have the option. That's why they are voluntary agreements. The problem is the governor and his rush to kind of marshal this narrative around immigration enforcement, have Florida lead this effort, has been trying to, with a very heavy-handed approach, force cities to do something that the law simply does not require.
But because the judge did, in fact, dismiss your suit, there really is no definable resolution to this case. And it feels as though what we've been left with is a sort of don't ask, don't tell status quo here, where South Miami does not require its police to assist in federal immigration enforcement as long as, well, you just keep your mouth shut. Explain to our listeners what we're essentially left with here.
You know, look, I think we are living in an environment where we all should take stock of how people are conducting themselves. And, you know, we should as public officials, first and foremost, serve the actual law, not serve our individual political agendas. And I think that's what the governor and the AG have been doing. They've been serving their personal political agendas for whatever advancement they think it will bring them, instead of doing service first to the law.
Right, but Mayor, with all due respect, my question was, what is the situation with, what is it now that South Miami can and cannot do as a, you know, in the sort of, as I said, the sort of status quo that we're in right now? What is the situation?
Tim, we will continue to do what we've always done. If we get a request from federal law enforcement at any level, we will provide them cooperation. But we do not need to, as I understand the outcome of this case, by the admission of the lawyers of the state, need to sign on to an agreement that creates all sorts of unnecessary obligations and provides a significant exposure in an area that I question the judgment of our participation. Personally,
okay,
I would say, and I don't want to speak for my board, there are a lot of conversations to have about whether local law enforcement should be frontline in this mission.
Right.
Can we support this mission? Absolutely.
So, but
frontline, I question the judgment.
You made an interesting point there just a second ago, though. South Miami, as far as you're defining it, is not compelled to join a 287G agreement, but you're still leaving the door open to South Miami police cooperation with federal immigration authorities if they request it.
Tim, and because that's what the law requires. Again, I want to be clear that the AG may be trying to spin this as a victory over people who are trying to obstruct his efforts to enforce federal immigration law. That's never been the case.
Okay.
What we have been trying to understand from the beginning is what are our legal obligations so that we can execute them faithfully. And I will tell you, we have always provided cooperation when it's needed, and we will if we are asked. But we do not need to take on this other mission simply because the governor and the AG want us to do that.
Okay.
And the courts have agreed, and they have agreed with us.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with South Miami Mayor Javier Fernandez about his city's lawsuit defying what Governor Santis claimed was a state law mandate that local police partner with federal immigration enforcement. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So Mayor Fernandez, as things stand, South Miami now believes it is not bound by Florida state law to enter into a so-called 287G agreement that would have its police take part in federal immigration enforcement. But whether state law demands a city's participation or not, remind us why you and South Miami originally objected in the first place to making cops partner with the feds this way under that kind of formal agreement.
Yeah, sir, happy to do that.
I believe liability had something to do with it. Yeah.
Yeah, so for example, if an illegal stop is executed and someone brings forward a civil rights action, South Miami would be on the hook for defending itself and its officer in the execution of this mission without any guarantees of indemnification from the state and or federal government. There are issues related to our collective bargaining agreement and our current insurance protections and whether it would expose us to more costs on those fronts as well. And then lastly, I would raise the policy question. In an environment where we have striven very hard to develop community policing as a strategy here locally, where officers wear body cameras to provide the greatest transparency into their interactions with local residents, You know, should we be taking on a mission where we see everywhere else in the country, ICE officers are acting to enforce immigration laws wearing masks mm-hmm. and not identifying themselves, right? In my mind, these missions can conflict with the goal mm-hmm. of community policing. Right. And so we should have the chance to have a conversation about what's most appropriate for our local communities.
Now, of course, Governor DeSantis and his Attorney General, James Uthmeyer, as you pointed out, they're claiming that they're the winners in this dispute because the judge dismissed your suit. Why do you feel their characterization of things is not accurate in that regard?
No, look, we certainly did not get an opinion on the merits. And ultimately, that is something that I regret. I wish another couple of cities would have stepped forward that had been directly menaced by the AG and the governor. I think we would have gotten the answer that we heard during oral argument, which is there is no mandate and you're not required to do this. You know, I'm hopeful that if nothing else, other cities are emboldened to push back and take a moment to reflect on what they should do when they're being, you know, met with heavy-handed tactics by the state.
Well,
and it's not provide resistance for resistance sake, but in an effort, again, to advance the rule of law first and foremost.
Right. And that brings me to a couple of my last questions here. Since you argue that the state has, in effect, conceded your point that Florida law does not compel local law enforcement to partner with federal immigration authorities, do you think we might see other cities and towns in Florida reconsider their own 287G agreements? You mentioned Key West, for example. Or is it just too politically risky for them to do that, given how adamant both Governor DeSantis and the Trump administration have been about local government cooperation in their sweeping migrant deportation campaign?
So, Tim, I don't want to play lawyer when I'm playing mayor here on the radio with you, but I think, you know, if you are thinking about rescinding your existing agreement, I think you're probably putting yourself in a posture where you are violating or possibly violating 908 Florida statute. But if you have not taken action on an agreement, you're not required to do anything. And I think that's really the message. For those cities who have not yet considered an agreement or taken one up, I think they can rest comfortably that in not doing anything, they're not putting themselves in any jeopardy. That is what I've taken away from the oral argument and the litigation that we've just completed, that was just completed. But I think those who have rushed to execute these agreements for political expediency and maybe regretting them now, I'd be very careful about how they try to unwind them because they may find themselves mm-hmm. in some jeopardy with the state.
But we should point out that under the law we're talking about, county governments, though, are compelled to cooperate in terms of what are known as detainer waivers and things.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Absolutely. So there is a distinction. If you do operate a jail, a jail facility, or you are a sheriff who does operate one, you are required to sign one. So that is why mm-hmm. Miami-Dade County executed that version of a 287G agreement earlier this year. And but most cities do not operate their own jails. So they do not find themselves in that particular predicament. Yes, sir.
But Mayor, in the minute we have left here, what about South Miami itself? Given the political climate surrounding this matter, do you worry you might now have a retribution target on your back because, as it turns out, your police won't be, at least in a partnership form, actively assisting the feds on immigration?
Listen, I don't worry about what other people are going to do. I can only control my actions and make sure that I discharge my duties with a clean conscience. And I can tell you, Tim, unreservedly, that's what we've done here. And my goal was first and foremost to protect my city manager, my police chief from any retribution by advancing this litigation. Mm-hmm. And I think we've gotten the clarity where they can rest easy in discharging their duties for the benefit of our public.
All right. Javier Fernandez is mayor of South Miami. Mayor Fernandez, thanks again as always. We appreciate it. Finally on the roundup, we want to pay tribute to an important South Florida matriarch who died this week, newspaper executive and international philanthropist Argentina Tina Schifano Hills. She was a driving force in Miami's cultural, civic, and media life, and along the way played an important role in Puerto Rican history, too. Hill was born in Italy. In 1950, she married Angel Ramos, the owner and publisher of Puerto Rico's leading newspaper, El Mundo. When Ramos died in 1960, Hills took over El Mundo Enterprises, and the Angel Ramos Foundation she built became the biggest in Puerto Rico. Hills later married Lee Hills, the Pulitzer Prize-winning editor of the Miami Herald and later chairman of Knight Ridder. True to form, she founded the Miami Foundation in 1967, guiding millions of dollars in charitable giving that shaped South Florida's arts, education, and community programs. In 1977, Hills also found time to become the first woman to head the Inter-American Press Association here. Hills is also the namesake of Bayfront Park's Tina Hills Pavilion and the Lee and Tina Hills Playground. Hills died Tuesday in Miami. She was 103 and just 11 days short of her 104th birthday. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.